Did you ever feel fetishized?
If you can't do that right, what can you do?
The worst that you've had.
All boys want to do is fuck.
Let's say fingered.
Why women should feel under pressure to give birth. Terrible kisser.
Hi everyone, welcome to the third episode of the O Collective Podcast. We are Eden, Diana, Winxy, and Simona. And we're all about female intimate wellness and pleasure. As modern third culture kids, we thought it can be helpful to share our guests and our own experience around sex and intimacy for anyone out there to navigate their way through life. Today, we're chatting with Amber Killa. Amber is a Chinese-Australian multidisciplinary creative. She's best known as a DJ and has done extensive work as a creative producer and consultant that worked with brands like Nike, Adidas, and more. In 2018, she co-founded Nu Shu, Chinese for woman skill. The project began as a woman and LGBTQ plus focused DJ workshop and evolved into connecting creatives. Across different disciplines through her personal project and podcast, Friend Crush. She shares the evolution in her understanding and perspectives on human connection, creativity, and authenticity as a way to encourage others to embrace the journey of self-understanding and empowerment. Hi, Amber.
Hi.
Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Amber, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up? What are your roots? What nationality are you? And what do you identify with?
I grew up in Perth, Australia. My family is from Fujian province, and I pretty much lived here consistently until my early 20s. When I graduated, I moved to Shanghai in 2017, and I was there until the end of 2019. And I came back to Australia for Chinese New Year, then COVID happened, and now I'm still in Australia, hoping to get back to Shanghai. My nationality is Australian, obviously, because I was born here. So I find it hard to find like something to identify with, because when I was growing up, I didn't really grow up around an Asian community. So I don't, even though I am like Chinese Australian, Asian Australian, I don't know what like the Asian Australian identity really is. I think it's very much more scattered than maybe the Asian American identity. And I don't necessarily identify that much with Asian American culture either, just like a few things here and there. And then obviously like I didn't grow up in China, so I'm not like mainland Chinese either. I think like identifiers are just helpful for other people to understand like where you might fit in. But in terms of like how I see myself, I just, you know, I am a product of all my different experiences and the places that I've lived. So I just try to keep it open-ended.
Also, to give our audience a little bit more of a background, what did you study? What did you want to become?
When I was younger, I think the first thing that I ever wanted to be was to be a fashion designer. I really wanted to go to design school when I was a kid. I was like obsessed with Alexander McQueen, obsessed with like the Antwerp designers. I wanted to go to Central St. Martin's when I was like 12, between the ages of like 12 to 14. Then I got into law school, pretty much hated it from like the second that I started. But my mom was like, you should get the law degree. You don't have to become a lawyer. You always quit things that you don't enjoy. Just finish this one thing. Like, I'm actually begging you, please. Cause I had started so many instruments as a kid. And then I'd be like, this is boring, and quit, start another one. Like a very just all over the place. And my mom, like, isn't a typical like Chinese tiger mom. She wasn't able to like force me to really do anything. Like, she'd encourage me to do Chinese class, but I was like, why would I need to learn Chinese? Everybody here speaks English. I don't have anyone to even speak Chinese to. So then I wasn't able to be consistent with Chinese class. Obviously, I regret that now. She never really forced me to learn an instrument, but I would want to learn instruments, and then I would get too hard and I would quit. So she was like, just do this law degree, please. You don't even have to be a lawyer. And obviously because I grew up with a single mom as well, and she worked really hard to give me access to education. I was like very blessed to grow up with material privilege in spite of the fact that I was raised by a single mother. So I was like, okay, this, the least I could do is honor the sacrifices that she made for me to go and get a good education to complete this degree for her. So I somehow managed to graduate, and then I was like, this sucks. No, I'm definitely not going to be a lawyer. I was like, okay, cool. I'm going to leave the country now.
Do you have a awkward sexual moment? Your first awkward sexual moment that you can recall?
Awkward sexual moment? Maybe probably my first kiss. I think like when you're younger, you definitely romanticize like the first kiss experience. You romanticize everything because like Hollywood. Yes. And I think I'm definitely a late bloomer when it comes to a lot of things. And I just remember like being at this house party, kind of just like doing my own thing as I do, dancing. This guy starts like getting closer and closer. We're kind of dancing together. I think I like turned around to like see where my friends were. And then suddenly he was like this far away from my face. Yeah, very slippery slope, you know? So I was just like, well, I guess this is happening, whatever, get it over and done with. And in comparison to all the other kisses that I've had, it actually didn't fare too badly. So I think it was a relatively good first experience. And yeah, I don't know. I don't really place that much weight on those kinds of things in general. I always felt like purity culture was a bit overrated.
Mm.
But yeah, that was funny because I was literally like, and then suddenly, well, whatever, he's cute.
Oh, there goes my first kiss. But you mentioned something about like bad kisses. That wasn't the worst that you've had. What was the worst that you've had?
I guess whenever you're kind of taken off guard, or if it's someone that I can't think of like specific experiences, but like in general, it's when you're taken off guard, or it's somebody that you mentally like are like, oh my God, he's so cute. Like you kind of build them up in your head. Mm-hmm. And then like when it actually happens, you're like,
and you're like, oh my fucking God, yeah, I've had this moment.
You're like, oh, I can't believe I wasted my energy getting excited about this.
Yeah. It'd be such a turn down. Would you actually still continue if you're dating the guy or seeing the guy, would you still give him a chance? Or is it after that first bad kiss, you're like, no, this is not for me?
I think by now, like that I'm older, it's like, if you can't do that right, what can you do? You know what I mean? Like when you're younger, it's different because like everybody's kind of learning, right? But if I'm dating a guy or I like hook up with a guy who's my age or older and he isn't a good kisser, it's like a bit concerning.
Feedback.
But what if he was just nervous? What if he was just nervous?
I think it's like that can be communicated and then you can give it another go. But like if it's like it happens and then there's like no awareness about the fact that it wasn't, you know, when it's like one-sided, like only you think it's bad but they think it's good, that's when it's like
the worst. Yeah, no chemistry or the wrong chemistry.
Yeah, and you know, shit happens. So
well, moving on to the next question. How did you learn about your sexual wellness growing up? How are you educating yourself now?
So when I was younger, I think it was maybe like the sealed section of teen magazines. I don't know if you guys grew up with like teen magazines, and then in the center, there'd be like a sealed section that you had to peel and there would be like questions. So like one of the magazines that I grew up with was called Dolly in Australia. And then the sealed section would be Dolly Doctor. And then there'd be like, readers would write in and ask different questions. So I think I learned a bit from that. We had health class at school, which was relatively informative in terms of like the biology of things. But I think there were a lot of things that if I was like educating teenagers about sex, I think there was other information that could have been included. But I guess also like at that age, it's kind of hard to contextualize.
Did you talk about sex with your friends?
After high school, I think we were more open about it. I think in high school, it was still very like kind of hush hush. I wouldn't say that I grew up in like a conservative environment, but it wasn't like super progressive either, like very white. suburban environment. So yeah, I think I was more like coming to terms with my racial identity when I was younger, less so than like sexual, because I've never really felt the need to like define my sexuality. It's just like something that, something to be explored, not something that I need to like stress too much about. And I think, yeah, I did a lot of Googling when I started being sexually active, just to make sure that everything was going the way that it was supposed to go. And obviously now I read the O Collective posts on WeChat. I think I've been on TikTok a lot for the last few months, and sometimes there's like information that gets pushed, different opinions, experiences, experts that provide like nuggets of information that has been interesting.
Compelling or interesting TikTok piece of advice that you've come across?
There was this one girl talking about like how your body can automatically respond in terms of like creating like wetness or discharge to the idea of like a sexual thing, but it doesn't, that doesn't equate to you being like intellectually aroused. So it can be like important to distinguish between just your body's automatic reaction and like whether you are actually aroused or turned on by something, kind of thing. Like the same way that our feelings are like a physical response to something, but the way that we conceptualize them in our minds can be different. You know, if you know what I mean? Like if I feel something and I think, oh, I'm angry because of what this person said, sometimes there's something else behind that that's related to like a past event or something. So like your body actually can do the same thing in terms of the way that it responds to like sexually charged stimulus. So I think like
that totally makes sense. It's almost like if you are, let's say, fingered enough times, eventually you'll most likely get wet even though you're not really feeling turned on.
Yeah. And then I think also it has to do with like just seeing like sexualized imagery as well. So it doesn't, just because your body has a reaction to it doesn't mean that it's like something that you're actually mentally aroused by as well.
I think our bodies are still more primal, and then we are probably developing on a certain area and our bodies are not catching up yet.
Yeah.
In a way.
But to that point, actually, I have been talking to quite a lot of men about their like performance anxieties, for example. A lot of them, they are very turned on mentally by the woman or their partner, but they're physically just inept to get hard. So there was like no physical reaction, but there is mental stimulus. So oftentimes that is also really confusing because they want to tell the girl, for example, or their partner, hey, I'm really into you, but I'm sorry, I just can't get hard right now because I'm nervous. I'm in this situation where I physically cannot react, but I'm really turned on. So I think that's also something very interesting, like for more people to learn about. And you mentioned something about like when you were in school, you learn more about the biology of sex, but it's so much more than that. There is like mental stimulus. There is sociology involved, psychology involved as well. So like until we like are able to mash all this together to talk about what sex is, it's not just one dimension.
Mm. Yeah. And also just like the, to your point about men and their experience, I think the way that we're socialized differently as genders as well. Like one thing that I've spoken to people about is how when you're younger, especially because I went to an all girls school, like there's this idea that men are just always thinking about sex. All they want is sex. This assumption that men just always are able to perform, but there are so many things that go into their ability to do so. Stress, sleep, you know, like that division between the part of your brain that has feel like connected to your feelings in your body, and then the part of your brain that is like able to function cognitively. Like you said, that actually separate parts of your brain that we need to learn to develop awareness of. Like, I just started reading this book that talks about how the part of our brain that has like physical feelings is separate to the part of our brain that has developed like our prefrontal cortex that allows us to like be human, different to an animal. So yeah, so many like things that it's such like a continuously developing body of knowledge, I think. So,
it's super interesting because we had our first podcast a couple of weeks ago, and we also discussed this point. It was Wingsy who mentioned that her awkward sexual moment was that she was actually having her first time sex, I think, with a guy, and he couldn't get it up. And then Eden, I think, asked, what went through your mind? Did you think, what is wrong with me? And Wingsy was like, no, I thought, what is wrong with him? And so we have like a lot of different points of views. Like some girls, because for me, I would also think, what is wrong with him? I wouldn't put that on me. I would be thinking, well, I'm here, I'm a girl, and it should be fine. And if he can get it up, it's on him, not on me. Mm. It's just funny to see how different people interpret these type of situations in a different way. I would just never, like, I think the general takeaway is just never think that it's you. It's always them. I'm very interested because you just mentioned that you also just, well, you went to an all-girls school. Do you think that also impacted your views on sex and sexuality and also how you grew up around it or were educated about it?
Yeah, I think so. Like, it would have an inevitable impact on how I saw sexuality and gender in general, I think. Just like thinking about my experiences and the context that I was in, I think even though it didn't really affect my views personally, but there was a lot of like homophobia even within a like girls context in, I remember in high school, like it being girls being made fun, like a way to make fun of a girl was to call her a lesbian, which is pretty messed up. Which is also common in boys' schools as well, probably more aggressively than in girls' schools, at least at the time. I don't know about now. I think that just being separated from boys during puberty would have a very intense impact on some girls, like that were boy crazy, like just trying to come to terms with that desire that comes up. I think it affected the way that I just saw like femininity and gender more so than sexuality specifically, because growing up at an all-girls school that was pretty like high performing, you were able to do anything as a girl. Like you could be competitive in sport, music, art. You were always always being encouraged to like achieve things, and in an environment that really nurtured like high achievement. So I never questioned my ability to do anything as a woman because I was always surrounded by girls who were really good at what they did and encouraged by teachers, like whatever you are passionate about, you should pursue. And then I think also like I was learning about feminism through art class and through English class. So I didn't question my ability to do anything as a girl until I left that all girls environment and went to university and then started working and then being around men more and in male dominated spaces. It was like, then I started to question myself and my identity and my ability to do things as a woman because I was being questioned by men all the time or in environments where I wasn't being taken seriously as a woman. So then that was like a whole thing that I had to go through, and then being able to reclaim my ability and my confidence in myself came after that, like basically trying to return to like my high school brain and being like, whatever you want to do, you can do. There's no reason why being a girl should stop you. So I think that was an interesting journey for me to be in an environment when I was younger where it was like, whatever you want to do, you can do. We're going to facilitate that. Then to like enter the real world and be like, wait, I can't do anything according to these people. And then being like, okay, actually, no, I can do whatever I want.
So your journey from a law student to becoming a creative consultant and DJ, a model in Shanghai, sounds pretty cool. How did your mom respond to that?
My mom hates me DJing. She's like, stop DJing because you're going to be up late at night and it's bad for your skin. You're going to get pimples. Not
It's such a Chinese mom reaction.
Yeah, she's like, well, oh yeah. I'm like, yeah, like. So yeah, but then obviously as a club DJ, which is what I was doing for like majority of the time when I first started DJing, you're out all the time. And then when I transitioned from club DJing to more brand DJing, like brand parties finish at like 10 p.m. and like you get paid so much more money. So I didn't have to DJ as regularly to in order to like push my profile. And then I also started to get like free stuff from brands because I was working with them. And I would like tell my mom and she'd be like, oh, that's great. With like the other stuff, I mean, my mom doesn't really get it, but I think she's still supportive in general. I think she she knows that I probably wouldn't be suited to the lawyer lifestyle.
Does it feel easier to be a female in this space opposed to maybe being a lawyer?
Well, I never really worked in a formal like legal environment, but from like conversations I've had with other women that work in law, I've heard that it can be like really tough to just like have to find a way to assert yourself in those kinds of spaces that are traditionally male dominated. I think I've been really lucky that a lot of my work experience has been in Shanghai, and even though I'm not physically in Shanghai, it's still very much connected to Shanghai as well. Like the agency, my main client now, like the one of their offices is in Shanghai too. So I think that Shanghai, my experience there, there's a lot of women that are working, especially in creative spaces. Most of the time when you're working with clients for brands, they're women. So I haven't found it difficult really to work with women or to just work in general in Shanghai. Like the gender part doesn't come into it as much. Yeah, how do you guys feel with your work in Shanghai?
Actually, when we worked in corporate, of course now is a whole different story. When we worked in corporate, I would say women were very, very empowered. And also our CEO was a woman from Shanghai. But I would say Shanghai and Beijing, Shenzhen, maybe the tier one cities in China is definitely the anomaly, because we have seen some stats of equality of men and women across China. There's still huge inequality for women, but we're just lucky that we are in places where we don't experience nor see it as much. To this day, we have seen stats that even in places like Guangdong, girls are still getting asked to marry or like have arranged marriages at age 16, for example. And to me, that sounds crazy. I'm like, what? Like, we have a female CEO from Shanghai, but just few provinces away, there's a girl who's 16 years old getting arranged marriage. So yeah, I would say there's still a lot of equality that needs to be caught up in China. But personally, I really have not experienced it myself.
Yeah, I think it's like a global thing for sure. Like even though on the surface, there are so many more discussions about, you know, gender equality, women empowerment, I think that like materially affects a very small percentage of women. And I consider myself extremely lucky to have been able to dodge, you know, a lot of the challenges that come with being a woman and working in corporate settings or whatever, just by virtue of being in Shanghai, in comparison to stories that I've heard from friends that work overseas, particularly in Western countries. But yeah, like I think, especially when it comes to class, there's so much more inequality that exists in terms of gender. When you're looking at like working class, people that are living in poverty, it's so much more difficult to even conceptualize like gender equality when you're not able to make ends meet, not able to get an education. So I think like, although I consider myself extremely lucky, and like you said, maybe we haven't experienced as many challenges directly, we're still really aware that these problems still exist on a huge scale. And it's more likely that we're an exception than the rule. So yeah, I'm very aware of that. And I think just from like the conversations that I have with women, like talking about gender equality isn't something that you can just assess like from the way that women experience their professional life. I think more and more now it has to do with just interpersonal relationships, how women see themselves, how they connect with themselves, with other women, with men in their romantic relationships. That is also something that needs to be addressed or spoken about, because it goes from like within, like it starts from within and then goes outward. You can't just say, oh, because I get paid the same amount as a man that I'm suddenly respected by men and by society. You know, like maybe in your personal relationships, you still struggle to assert yourself, and that has a huge impact on like how equality or how women and men even can be empowered. So I think that's like the next frontier beyond just like everybody being able to work, because capitalism wants everyone to work anyway. It doesn't matter. It's better when men and women work. I think it's like that inner empowerment. That's the next challenge for people, society.
Hear your guys' point of view here. I feel a bit different about this. When I grew up, so my parents are from Wenzhou, and I don't know, I think Wenzhou is viewed as they're the entrepreneurs of China. I see all the Wenzhou family members coming to Europe, and they're all starting their own businesses, and it's always a husband and a wife, and it's very equal in terms of how they like the work or how, the relationship between the two of them. And I sit in the conversations when they talk about money, and then money is also equally divided, how they handle the kids is equally divided. So I feel the part of China that I've seen, and those are the Chinese people that came to Europe to work, they're pretty equal when it comes to work and interpersonal relationships. Mm. But I definitely know that there's a lot of inequality. Also, when I travel back to China and I go to my parents' local towns, I see that there's more inequality there. Like the woman, she's in charge of the household and the man brings in the money. But I feel there's some type of development for the Chinese that went abroad, and it was just required from both of them, bringing money to the table and their responsibilities when it comes to family and family duty.
So you think that like locally, it wasn't women weren't expected to work, they were expected to just look after the home. But for the Chinese that left, it was more likely that both parents would be working?
Yeah, because I feel locally, it's also different times, right? So I'm talking about my parents' age. So they grew up in the 1960s and 70s. Locally, when you're at home, you know, you would work on the farms, you would work in the factories. And then it's very traditional that the woman stays at home and she takes care of the kids, and the man would go to the factory or work on the land. But as soon as you go abroad, there are no factories or land where you work on. When they go abroad, most of them, they start their own businesses, or they start to work for somebody else first. They need to bring in money. So their first duty is to earn money and to send it back to China, probably to their family. So it's a responsibility for the both of them. And then I also see that back at my parents, like they both came to the Netherlands and they needed to work. So they both started in restaurants. And then afterwards, they started their own restaurants together. But the efforts and the work that they put into the restaurants is equal. It's not that my mom stayed behind to take care of me and my sister. No, she also just stood in a restaurant and worked.
I think the stakes would be different for Chinese that leave China and go overseas, because there's like the racial barrier that you face as well. You're not guaranteed to be taken seriously as an immigrant the way that you are when you're just working locally in China, I think. And then also the added pressure of being the people that leave the mainland, and then, like you said, like earning money that can be sent back to China. It's better if both people are working than just one person, because then maybe like the man working can support the immediate family, but there's not enough money to send back home. So I think that's why, like, both, especially for the, like the generation of our parents, like first wave of immigrants, first and second wave, like they had so many more challenges in terms of entering a new country, language barrier, being considered and treated as an immigrant. Like, you're not going to be able to just like, your degree doesn't transfer into the local whatever. And I think I remember someone asking me, like, or commenting that when they were younger, it was always other Asian children that had divorced parents, but never like white parents. It wasn't that common when I was growing up for people to have divorced parents the way that I did. And my friend asked me, like, why do you think that is? And I asked my mom, and she was like, it's because all the Asian women have to work when they're, so they have their own money. They don't need to stay with their husband if they have their own money. Whereas for a lot of the like Australian families that I grew up around, that only the dad worked and the mom was a housewife. And my mom would always say, like, just because like people are married doesn't mean that they're happy. And a lot of people stay married for money, because if they have to split their assets and suddenly someone has to live in an apartment, can't maintain that standard of living. So yeah, it's interesting how I think like my mom and dad came to Australia together and both of them were always working. And when they split up, it was like the decision wasn't so difficult in terms of like financial for my mom, because she already owned a business. And yeah, she was like looking at her interests, at my interests, not thinking like, oh, we needed to stay together because I need money. She was like, I have my own money.
Is there anything like one big lesson when it comes to sexual wellness and intimacy that you've discovered?
As with like just anything in life, as I'm kind of learning or also trying to just like emphasize, is that as you get older, especially coming out of your early 20s, I think it's really important to learn to connect with yourself and what you really want out of life, and to learn what your boundaries are, especially in like, because that affects every part of your life, your friendships, your relationships with your family, your romantic relationships, your work, and also the way that you, also your sexual experiences as well. Because I think when you're younger, especially as a woman, there are a lot of ways that you can be coerced into certain situations and like, oh, you know, like being pressured into certain things or feeling like you need to compromise. And one thing that I am starting to own so much more when I reflect on previous experiences that I've had, when I talk to other girls about experiences that they've had, it's that you need to also learn how to say no in a lot of situations too, because a lot of men will just, they don't hear what you're saying. And they'll think that they do still think that there's a way around your boundaries. And I think more than ever now, I'm starting to realize or reflect on the times when I wasn't able to fully own what my boundary was. And I was put in a situation where I allowed something to happen that I wasn't ultimately comfortable with happening. And I think those experiences can be very subtle and insidious. You don't consciously realize what is happening at the time because you're caught up in the moment, or like your insecurity gets the better of you, or like your desire to please or impress somebody gets the better of you. And then you might not like actually reflect on those experiences and start to normalize, like in like worst case scenario, being taken advantage of. So even though that's not really like a kinky thing, but I think it's like really important, because I've spoken to so many women that are like, I have been put in situations where I've doubted my intuition, or I haven't been able to assert a boundary, and they regret it, or they're like, I would never do that again, or if I could go back in time, I would have been more assertive and been willing to walk away from a situation or a person that would allow me or like try to take advantage of me in that way.
That's interesting. I think boundary is like a very interesting word that I've heard you keep using. In also the last episode, we interviewed Hua Hua. She does shibari art bondage. So mm-hmm. She was also saying that through shibari and this rope bondage, people are able to learn more about their physical and emotional cues of what their boundaries are. So I think that's mm-hmm. really interesting, like on how we can even educate the next generation on like how to communicate what boundary is and what's the extent that they are okay with.
Yeah, and I think it's like an ongoing journey to understanding as well. Like even though you can say like boundaries, standards, etc., like having to like the practice of returning to yourself and like asking yourself what it is you really want, what you're comfortable with in any given moment is important, because it can change as well. Like what my boundaries were when I was younger might be different to what they are now, what they might be in the future, what they are like within each connection or situation can change too. So that's why it's like nobody can tell you what they are. Only you can really know what they are for yourself, and then only through communicating with whoever in whatever context, friendship, work, romance, can you like get to a place where it's like mutually beneficial instead of like one person having to benefit, you know, at the other person's expense. I think that's kind of like a lot of maybe traditional or like older school thinking is very much based around this win-lose concept. And I think moving forward, people are able to see, especially with movements like feminism, that like, okay, women don't have to be getting the shorter end of the stick in order for men to do well. There is a way for people to come together and mutually benefit in relationships, in work, in friendships. So long way to go, I think, but it starts with each person. So I think that's kind of what I try to encourage, because as I've always been interested in learning about feminism in like a social context, like generally speaking, what I have discovered through my experience with projects like Nushul, which is to center women and the LGBTQ community, and through self-education, through the podcast as well, it's like sometimes these concepts can seem so abstract to us, like just statistics that we see, and it's like, okay, yeah, there is inequality, but then you don't know like what your contribution can be to change, because you're like, well, how do I just make sure that women are treated equally in business when they're not, you know? And I think instead of like focusing so much on just those bigger social issues, understanding how it manifests in our personal lives. And that's where I think boundaries comes in for women, being able to say no, being able to know when they need to assert themselves. That's how change happens. Because if you're waiting for society to give you permission or to empower you without you knowing that you need to be empowered, knowing what it takes to be empowered, then we just end up going around in circles. Yeah. So it's like complicated, but simple at the same time. And I think that's what I try to understand and explain or like break down.
What would you recommend our listeners to learn more about feminism? Where are you getting all your information? What books are you reading? Are you listening to any podcasts?
Things that I read when I was younger were books like The Beauty Myth by Naomi Wolf. That book, even though like the author is kind of, I don't know, she kind of like lost her marbles a little bit now, there's still like good points made in that original book. Another book is All About Love by Bell Hooks. They talk about like romantic relationships and the power dynamics in like hetero relationships. I think like now I'm looking more at books that talk about just personal empowerment, because I think regardless of your gender in the society that we live in now, I actually think like no matter what your gender is, everyone's kind of having a shit time. Not having a shit time, or life is hard for everybody, regardless of gender. And I think that, you know, the first few waves of feminism focused very much on the ways that women were being oppressed and how can women get to the same level as men. But I actually think that it has a lot more to do with like how individuals, regardless of gender, can empower themselves and develop like a sense of self that exists separate to whatever societal expectations they've internalized, you know. And for men, there's so many pressures that they face too that I think are overlooked, and that actually sets women behind as well, because then men aren't as likely to support women or ally with women because they'll think that something's being taken away from them and their empowerment from women being able to further their own interests too. So I think now I've moved from like a, oh, it's men versus women situation to like, how can we all connect and support each other together? Because I don't want women to just be getting ahead and then men be left behind either. Like real feminism does encompass all genders. So I think what's more important now is actually for people to just learn about self-empowerment. And then for that, I've read books about like self-esteem. And one of the books I always recommend is The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem by Nathaniel Brandon, because it's like a gender neutral kind of way to understand self-empowerment. I want men to also reflect on their life too. And then a book that I've been reading at the moment is How to Do the Work, I think, by
With all of these books and learnings about self-empowerment, what is the one biggest takeaway then that you've had? Because we're also talking about women that need to recognize when they can say no. And I think that's also a form of self-empowerment. So if we want to put this into practice, you've been studying a lot apparently on this topic already. Like, what is the biggest takeaway that they tell you to do when it comes to empowerment?
I think the main takeaway is being able to recognize that it's normal to make mistakes, and that it's what's important is that you learn from them, and that there is no there is no silver bullet that is going to change your life overnight. It takes like consistent practice and work. Like the book that I was just about to recommend called How to Do the Work by Nicole LaPera. She's a psychologist, I believe, and she has like a holistic approach to psychology and wellness. So I think like where Western science is starting to catch up is the concept of like mind-body connection. Mind, body, and spirit are all connected. Previously, they would consider these things separately. And I think in like Eastern traditions and religions, these things have always been considered as like working together. But in her book, she talks about how these things are connected, and that, you know, recognizing your shadow self, being able to accept your flaws, being able to accept mistakes that you've made in the past or experiences that were traumatic, it's an ongoing practice of being able to develop an awareness of like your triggers or your patterns of behavior, how you can choose better for your future self. And I think that with modern society, there's this idea that it's like, okay, I'm just going to buy this thing and then my problems will be solved. Or if I just do this thing one time, if I just go to the gym for 3 hours one time, then I won't ever have to work out again. But like anything, yeah, you need to, like, it's a practice. You've got to do it regularly, and then the benefits start to compound. So I think the main takeaway for me has been to like have patience and just to be consistent. Like small steps and small progression is more valuable, more meaningful than one overnight awakening. You know, it's never really like that for most people. And even if it is one moment of awakening, you still need to take what you learn from that moment and apply it every single day moving forward if you want it to actually make a difference. There's so many distractions, so many different messages, advertising. Like, I think people underestimate the degree to which they are marketed to now, especially with social media, like being in our pocket at all times. Influencer culture as well. Like, there's always things that are being sold to you as like a solution, because that is what marketing is supposed to do. And it's not about whether that's right or wrong, but I think just developing an awareness of that, which is then getting in touch with like, okay, what do I really want? What is realistic for me? What am I trying to achieve, and how can I get it without thinking that it's going to come from me just buying this thing or buying that thing? You know, it doesn't mean you can't buy things, but I think our relationship with how we consume has impacted the way that we're able to actually like grow in some ways, because we're not used to like the resistance that comes with having to make those sorts of changes. That's something that I try to like just remind people of, because I always get questions like, how do I learn how to DJ? How do I become a DJ? I'm like, literally, like, I Googled how to be a DJ when I started DJing, and there's like a WikiHow page, and I would watch YouTube videos, and then I would DJ like every single weekend, and I would play for free. I would play shit parties. I would play like, so that I had to learn that way. And that's the same with literally anything. And sometimes you're not aware that that's what you're doing if you actually, you know, really enjoy what you're doing. But when it comes to like certain things that people want to learn that they don't have an understanding of, don't have a natural inclination towards, they expect it to come overnight. But it's a practice, everything.
You've been growing up both in the West and you've spent some time in Asia right now. And then with all the learnings that you had, do you see any big differences between Asia and Australia, or maybe China and Australia, or Shanghai and Perth?
Yeah, I found that Shanghai, even though it can be clicky, as like any city can be, I feel like people are a lot more open in China in general. And I think it has to do with the way that WeChat functions, because there's like one communication app that everybody has. So when you meet someone, it's like, oh, Zhao Weixing, like, it's so normal. It's so easy to connect with people. Whereas I feel like in Australia, there's more like, it's like, oh, well, do I add you on Instagram, or do I add you on Facebook, or do I take your phone number? Like, there's more like barriers, I think, to getting to know someone. Like I was talking to an Australian friend about this and they were like, yeah, I would literally need to meet somebody 7 times before I added them on Facebook. But in China, like you might just meet someone 1 time, you know, and add them on WeChat and you might never speak to them again, or you might become best friends with them. Like you never know. So that's something that I always really appreciated about Shanghai, because I felt like in Perth, you know, I grew up in a bubble inside of Perth already, like living in the suburbs, and it can be very cliquey as well. I can't imagine like being a foreigner coming to Perth and then like trying to make friends in the circles that I grew up in. I can imagine that being really hard. And I've had friends that have dated outside of their social circle here and said that their partner found it really strange the way that people here just like socialize and stuff. So that's something that I always really loved about just China and Shanghai, because I feel like I've been able to connect with so many people in from all over China. Like if I'm working in another city, you know, you're just adding like photographers, makeup artists, hairstylists, everyone's, you've got everyone's WeChat. And then if another project comes up, you can easily get back in touch with them and communicate with them. But like in the West, when I'm working on projects and it's all via email, and it just seems so much more like, I don't know, detached a little bit when you're dealing with people in that way. For like, I think when I was growing up in Perth, because I was like one of the only Asian girls, there was like no, and there was like no media representation for Asians in general. I felt like almost asexual. I was like, I didn't feel desirable by boys, even if like years later they'd be like, oh, I had a huge crush on you. And I would like, I just like was, I don't know if it's just because I'm oblivious or because I just wasn't that sexually charged when I was a teenager. But I think going to Shanghai and just seeing, like going to clubs and just seeing Chinese girls like off their rocker, drunk, like all over, boy crazy, I was like, oh, this is like a completely different experience. It's like a weird thing to just, it's something that I didn't expect to take me by surprise in terms of like culture shock, just like seeing lots of Chinese girls embracing their sexuality openly. Like I never saw that when I was growing up, and I was like always had comments made about me because of my race and how that might connect with my sexuality. But I think it's so different when you're in China and like everybody is Chinese, so there isn't that like separation.
What comments did you get in Australia about your race and sexuality?
Like assumptions that were being made about whether I was promiscuous or frigid, or like being tokenized, like, oh, well, you know, they only want to get with you because they've never been with an Asian girl before.
Did you ever feel fetishized?
Yeah, definitely. It would have been hard for me not to, just like the environment that I grew up in, because I was like one of the only Chinese girls. Even though I don't walk around thinking about how I'm Asian, I was always being reminded that I was seen as different to people, whether it was explicitly or like covertly. So I think that kind of, I don't know, it mentally maybe isolated me a bit. I was just like, I don't want to deal with anyone for a long time. But then I think as I got older and just meeting like certain people didn't create that feeling or that environment, and I felt safer with them. So I think, and also like Shanghai is a very international city as well, very cosmopolitan. So I think that, yeah, like my experiences there were less so. But then also like, again, when you're dealing with like foreign guys, they always have something messed up to say.
I actually had this with my boyfriend. My boyfriend, he's white. Mm-hmm. Before we knew each other, one of his best friends told him, I foresee you ending up with a Chinese girl. But then Chinese, because she would be very submissive in a way, she would do the household. They had this stereotypical image of what a Chinese or Asian girl should or would be, and they thought that he would end up with a girl like that. Now the joke's on him, because I might be an Asian girl, but I'm none of all of those stereotypes. I don't cook, yeah. I don't clean, I don't And that's, yeah.
Actually, that reminds me of another awkward experience that I had with a boy. I think we had been like talking. I think he worked at like a store that I would always walk past when I was going to like a class or something. I like randomly did like a makeup course when I was at university because I hated law. So I was like, let me do something that interests me. So like the place where the beauty course was like in this kind of mall, and I would always walk past this liquor shop that he worked at. So I would kind of like talk to him from that. And so we got to know each other. And then I remember we went to a party, or we were at a party or something, and we kissed. Terrible kisser. I was like, oh, this is so awkward. Like, I don't know.
Bye.
And then I was like, he would like lean in again, and I would kind of like pull away. And then he made a comment like, oh, you're so shy, or you're so timid or something. And I literally wanted to be like, you just suck at kissing. Like, but I was just like, yeah, whatever. Believe whatever you want to believe. Yeah, like things like that. It's like, you wouldn't have really said that if I wasn't Asian. I knew that the language he was using was very specific to the way that he saw me. Mm. So I was like, well, you're a bad kisser anyway, so I'll see you later.
I think when I was younger, I was too oblivious to even remark these type of comments and to know that they are connected to how we look like. Mm. Too oblivious for that.
I was like hyper aware of like my race when I was younger, and also like gender, like racial inequality, gender inequality, class inequality. I don't know why, but I just was like, once I saw it, I could not unsee it. And I think I became aware of it at a much earlier stage than a lot of the people that I was around, and it caused like a lot of issues for me, because when I started to, like in my early 20s, when around like 2015, 2016, I would say that's when like social media, people were having conversations about it on social media, like internationally. That influenced me to then also speak about things, mostly in a satirical way. Like I would just make jokes about like racism that I had experienced. And like, even though I was looking like outside of Australia, I think it was like very like a lot of American media and stuff talking about those sorts of issues. I was still physically in a very small kind of conservative suburban town. So a lot of people were like not ready for those conversations. But I think now, like 5-6 years later, there's a lot more awareness around those issues in Perth. Like, it's been good to come back and see the progress that's occurred since I've been away, because one of the reasons why I left was because I was like, I can't like be who I want to be in this environment if there are going to be so many expectations for how I should present myself as an Asian woman. Like, they're not going to say to my face that that's the reason, but I know that there are barriers that come with that. That's why I left. And to come back and for there to be more support for like young women of color, people of color, especially in the local DJ scene, has been really inspiring and like affirming to see.
How old are you? Like, I'm 31. Everyone is like slowly settling down, buying a house, getting married, getting engaged. And I'm like, am I the problem here?
I think when I think about that, I think it's because, I don't know about you guys, but when I was younger, like, especially because I grew up in like the suburbs as well. Like, when you're a kid, all of the adults that you know are the parents of your friends. So like, you just think that, oh, when people are 30, when people are 40, they're just parents. Like, everybody just has children at that age. You don't, like, I didn't know any other 30-year-olds when I was a kid that lived the life that we live, you know what I mean? So like, you just kind of subconsciously expect like, oh, by the time I'm 30, I'm going to be having children like the other 30-year-olds that I knew. But then when you actually get like closer to that age and you don't choose to become a parent, then life continues in a different direction in a way that you didn't necessarily think was possible when you were younger. And especially now that like the economy is different, social expectations are different, I think there's like so much more room there's so many more options available for people. It's natural to struggle with, especially as a woman. Like, do you need to settle down? But I think it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know. Like, deep down, like, personally, I feel like I don't need to get married. I don't need to get engaged. I still don't want kids right now. But like, I still feel this like pressure coming from outside, like culture, society, parents. They're just like, your time's ticking, but I don't feel it.
As long as you're happy.
I still live like I'm 25.
And I should be the one from the three of us that is should be most worried. I'm 33 actually. So that's for me, the time really. Yeah, time is ticking. That's what I hear every day. It's not only what I hear, it's what I see. Like friends getting their second babies and friends getting their first babies, second babies.
Is like so overrated.
Okay. The world is already overpopulated.
I'm gonna cut this part out and blast it on social media. Having babies is overrated. Everybody's having babies right now.
Like, I don't judge people that have children, obviously, because it's like, from an evolutionary perspective, it's important to continue the human race. But I think that there's really no reason on a personal level why women should feel under pressure to give birth if they don't want to, because it is a huge physical, mental, emotional risk and burden to take on, firstly, to grow a child, then financially to bring up a child and the responsibility that comes with it. I mean, just for me personally, I would want to, even though I know there's like no right time to have children, I still would want to be in a specific like financial position with the right person to have children kind of thing. I don't think you as a woman need to be defined by whether you have or don't have kids kind of thing.
I totally agree with that, but there's always this but part. There's like this inherent feeling of, I don't know, biology and
Course. I think it's written into our DNA.
DNA.
And I know that like because I'm not I'm still, you know, not 30 yet, I think that's when those questions come up more. I'm still like, why do I need a rush? It's normal for your body to want those things or drive you to do those things, but your ability as a human is the ability to choose whether or not you want to do that or not. Like an animal just has the urge and goes and pursues it, but as a person you have the ability to make conscious choices for yourself. It's like your life's work to differentiate between those two things and figure out what you actually want for yourself, because maybe your body is like, maybe it's time for babies, but maybe you're like, I don't know if I really want to have babies, and then figuring out what to do instead. And there's so many options available too. Like in my eyes, I'm like, okay, if I didn't have a biological kid, I could adopt a kid. I could foster children. Express the maternal instinct, which I think is what you're ultimately trying to figure out what to do as a woman. Like, how do you connect with your like divine feminine, maternal instinct? How do you express that? It doesn't have to be from having your own children. But the pressure is definitely there. And it's almost a humanitarian act to have children now, because the birth rates are so low. Like when you think about it from a social perspective and like, oh, what are we going to do with no labor force in the future and an aging population? It's like charity to have babies now. And if you do, there's so many options. Like Lucy Liu is like 50 something and she had a kid from insemination from a sperm donor with a surrogate. A few years ago.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously she's an actress and she has lots of money, so options come when you have money, but still, you know, like she was still able to have a kid.
To end the podcast, what is one piece of advice you would tell all girls and women out there to know and never forget?
I would say that it's okay to make mistakes. That's part of life. As long as you learn from your mistakes, keep figuring out how to stay true to yourself, because there's always going to be barriers and obstacles and expectations. So don't forget who you are, who you want to be. Another piece of advice would be to follow your interests as well and maintain a connection to those things, because that is what makes you unique. Your unique perspective on the world is so valuable, because being like other people is like not interesting to anybody, not to you, not to other people either. So yeah, even if you get made fun of for being different, it's also more profitable to be different too. All the things I got bullied
definitely
for, I make money off now. And yeah, don't take life too seriously. Have fun. You were not born to be ugly or have a bad time. That's what I would say.
We also know that you have your own podcast.
So my podcast is called Friend Crush. I just kind of talk about things that I'm thinking about or learning about, kind of generally around like self-discovery, self-empowerment.
If people want to know more about Amber, where can they find you?
You can find me on everything at Amber Akilla, Instagram, Weibo, Xiaohongshu. I just managed to log into my Chinese social media again. TikTok at Amber Akilla, SoundCloud at Amber Akilla, Spotify at Amber Akilla,